welcome to Northpod Law Series 6, Episode 5, recorded on the 24th of October 2012. It's all a bit bizarre. Hello, dear listeners. Hello, hello. The penultimate episode of Series 6 is upon us.
Hello.
Hello, Bezic. Hello, Holt.
Hello.
Quite a lot to get through, so do sit comfortably, if you will. We're going to be talking in this week's episode about a press release from Amnesty International regarding the United Kingdom and removal of people to Syria. We're talking about a case called X v. the Secretary of State for the Home Department on the rights of a sex offender to make representations before, and I'm just going to call it by the acronym CSOD, disclosure.
Mm-hmm. Claire's law, in other words, really?
Yeah, a little bit, kind of, yeah.
You like us talking about that, listeners. It's not like we have a rant about it, what, every week?
I don't think we've talked about it this series.
No, rant heads on.
Then we've got the Crown against Simmons about drugs into prisons. Very, very weird case. It's all a little bit bizarre. A case called Halliwell, which you've probably heard about in the news, regarding admissibility of confessions. But
first, we're going to do what we promised we'd do last week.
That's the first time for everything, isn't it, listeners, really? We trailed something that we're actually going to do in the next episode. I'm going to keep it short. It's one really for the practitioners, I suppose. Let's see what we can do with it. All right, so there are changes regarding committal proceedings. Well, in fact, there's a very big change regarding committals. Mm-hmm. They are going to be no more as of, I think the date is right, the 5th of November. You'd think we'd remember that.
To be fair, it's not like you get paid for them, so hey.
No, quite. It's easy to forget.
Well, you do get paid for them. You get paid for them in your brief fee.
It's part of the brief fee.
I've no doubt they're going to start clawing something back from the brief fee. Shall I say that very quietly in case somebody in power is listening?
Don't give them ideas, Kirsten. All right, so brief summary then is this. There are new provisions brought in by the Criminal Justice Act 2003 to ensure, as they put it, that criminal cases run more efficiently and are dealt with by the level of court appropriate to their seriousness, which is a bit similar to, you know, the way they were dealt with before that act. Here's a quick guide, a whistle-stop tour of what those provisions are. Firstly, they will make procedural changes to the current system of plea before venue. More on that in a minute. They will abolish committal proceedings. As Kirsten says, well, no one was getting paid for them anyway, so whatever.
No one ever did anything about them either. How often did you see a challenged committal?
I have done three, and I think that's probably a record for a practitioner of 2004
yes.
Court.
And I've lost track of the number of Crown Court briefs I've come through, I've picked up and gone, how did this get here?
Yeah, well, yeah, I've seen some that should have been, I quite agree.
I do feel slightly sorry for some of the members of the junior bar in London, because committals were, for when I was down there, they were definitely a good piece of news, because that'd be, say, £50, and not a lot of time out of chambers.
And I suppose a prospect that you'd get to keep the brief, depending on what it was.
It would certainly stay in chambers.
Probably not so much keeping hold of the brief in London.
Keeping hold of the brief
so
in the loosest
like
sense of the word.
Yes. Until you handed it to a more senior practitioner, I'm guessing.
But a good bit of time for you to introduce yourself to the instructing solicitors.
Yeah, sure. And in all honesty, one of those occasions where 6-2s were pursued, was when a junior member had hold of it, really didn't have any other involvement in it, and sort of thought, well, I'll dive into it in some detail then. Mm. And often that would lead to, oh, hang on a minute, there's no evidence of this.
Because at that stage, they're all keen and terribly interested.
Indeed.
It's going to make you really popular in chambers, isn't it, with the senior practitioners? Yes, you had this really good brief.
Yeah, it's gone now. Great news.
I've done a
good
story.
Good news, everyone. The other changes being brought about are that the prosecution will be allowed to introduce the defendant's previous convictions when deciding venue. Actually, do you know what? That used to happen quite a lot anyway.
Yes.
Because it's quite often
allowed.
Around about the same time as a bail application. Just imagine that.
Yeah.
They will also allow adult defendants, now this is quite interesting, who have indicated a not guilty plea. Right, remember, so they, I'm not guilty, do you remember that bit, or have given no indication as to plea, to seek an indication from the court of whether a custodial or non-custodial sentence would be more likely following a guilty plea in the magistrate's court. Yeah. Now, in the Crown Court, these are things called Goodyear indications. Very often utterly incorrectly called Goodyear Directions, because people seem to always seem to call them that, and I don't know why. Anyway, Goodyear Indications. And that's because you're dealing with experienced judges who know what the law says, know that they're not promising something in particular, know that there is a written procedure that must be followed to have such an indication. It's all right in the lower court. I'm not guilty. Would you like to know how much you're going to get if you plead guilty?
Well, it's not how much you're going to get, is it? It's are you going to get a custodial or non-custodial? And to be fair, if they are, if the answer is you're going to get a non-custodial if you plead and then he pleads, presumably it's going to be that bench that sentences him.
Well, one would think
are.
I think that must be right.
Is it, though?
You get there early enough in the morning, I'd have thought so, yeah. It's only really a problem. Do they have to give them?
No.
So if it turns out to be there's mental health issues or a domestic violence incident, the bench can say no, because it's going to take too long to do a pre-sentence report.
And they're only allowed to give them if they've been requested. Although how long that remains the case, we'll wait and see.
Are you allowed to invite somebody to request, do you think?
Well, in the Crown Court, we know we've covered this before, but in the Crown Court, it does happen now that Crown Court judges will volunteer.
Would you like an indication, Mr. Knight?
Well, not even just that. Some of them say, well, you know, I mean, if he were to plead guilty to this stage, he might be looking more like this, which is all very, very helpful and very useful to the bar to some extent, but also might fall foul of what is a fairly established rule about inducement to pleading guilty, which of course is unlawful. But anyway, we should read the Court of Appeal authorities on that. Very interesting. But anyway, bygones. These provisions will also amend the power to commit defendants to the Crown Court for sentence and will introduce plea before venue for youths in certain cases. All right, I'm going to try and run you through a quick version of this now. If it doesn't make sense, then, well, kind of tough, really. Go and look it up. It's available. There is a document called Supporting Materials for Legal Advisors, which is published in May, actually, but ahead of the pilot of this in June, from recollection. It's not terribly interesting, save for the fact you will need to know it if you're a practitioner. So for an adult defendant charged with an either-way offence, for the non-lawyers, that's an offence that can be tried either in the Magistrates' Court or in the Crown Court. If he's charged with either-way offence and not linked to any other defendants or related offences, first question is it a case where there's been a notice served under Sections 51B or 51C of the CDA 1998? In short, is it a serious sex offence or serious violent offence? If the answer is yes, then send forthwith to the Crown Court, Section 51. Nothing changed there.
Right.
If the answer is no, the next step is plea before venue. And so the first question is there a guilty plea or a not guilty plea or no indication?
So nothing changed.
Let's imagine there's a guilty plea. If the person is then convicted of a specified offence and qualifies for sentence for IPP or extended sentence...
Well, straight up to the ground.
That's
nothing's changed.
Yeah, that's going to change anyway fairly soon. Then, yes, off you go to the Crown Court under Section 3A of the Power of the Criminal Courts and Sentencing Act 2000, no less. If the answer is no, they're not an IPP or EPP type person, is the offence so serious that the Crown Court should have power to deal with them? If the answer is yes, then send it to the Crown Court. It's oddly worded, that, actually. If the answer is no, then sentence in the Magistrates' Court. So far, so good. If at the plea before venue the person says, I ain't done it, or I'm not telling you whether I've done it, then the decision as to allocation needs to be taken. Now, this is where one of the changes kicks in. So the prosecution at this point can inform the court of the previous convictions. If the trial on indictment is more suitable, then off it goes to the Crown Court. If summary trial is more suitable, the question is, does the defendant request an indication of sentence?
It's going to increase the number of cases going up to the Crown, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's probably right, but that's not the intended consequence,
no.
I don't think, but we'll see how it runs. Is there an indication of sentence requested? The next question, I suppose, is whether the court is prepared to give an indication. If the answer is yes, we will give an indication, then the question arises, does he want to reconsider his indication of plea? If the answer is no, does he consent to summary trial? If the answer is yes, he does consent to summary trial, off you go to summary trial. That is that. Although, at that point, the prosecution may apply for the offence to be sent to the Crown Court for trial, where the magistrate's sentencing powers are inadequate. But, of course, really, that's the same position you used to have with committals. The only other option left at this point, then, is whether the person says, I now do want to change my plea. the same question arises, is he an IPP or EPP? If the answer is,
I presume you'd have known that already by the time you've had your...
You would hope so. If the answer is no, then he's sentenced in the magistrate's court. If the answer is yes, he's sent to the Crown Court. So in other words, not much has changed, save for the fact you've got this sort of Goodyear-like performance that goes on once he said he hasn't done it.
But also presumably looking to see whether there's no mention here, it doesn't seem to be, and whether the magistrate's court's powers of sentencing are sufficient. Seems to very much say, well, yes, if he pleads guilty to it, we'll sentence you here. Well, he's not going to be able to do that if it doesn't have to be an EPP or a...
Well, no, there is. If the defendant consents to a summary trial, then as long as before the trial begins,
right,
the question is then considered whether the magistrates have sufficient powers.
Of course.
Then
but he wouldn't be consenting to a magistrate's court because they would decide whether they're sending it or not.
Well, quite right, yeah. Well, it would appear that that's no longer the
route.
It
just doesn't seem to be.
No.
They just missed a vital step somewhere.
No, I've covered every box.
Not you.
Oh, whether they've missed one. No, it's entirely possible. It's only been around for...
you're
going to
get
May.
People who've not a serious specified offence. I don't know, but you know.
I agree, it's not entirely...
It's not crystal, is it?
No, not really. You've then got the allocation procedure for a young defendant. A bit simpler, actually. So are they charged with homicide or a relevant firearm offence? Oh, yes, I forgot to mention that before. That's that 51B, 51C, yep. That includes firearms. An offence where a notice has been served, which is complex fraud or one involving a child. Again, that's 51B and C. Or if they're a dangerous offender. If the answer is yes to any of those, off you go to the Crown Court. If the answer is no, then you move on to the next set of... offences. So is he charged with an offence related to an offence which is already being sent, an offence to which has already been sent to the Crown Court? Is it one that is capable of being a grave crime? That is interesting because it's not entirely clear how you assess that capability. Or is he charged jointly with an adult co-accused who has been sent to the Crown Court? If the answer is no to any of those, then you take a plea and you proceed to deal with matters in the youth court. If the answer is yes to any of those, then you deal with plea before a venue and ask the person to indicate a plea. If they say guilty, three options, first of all, must commit for sentence if they're satisfied it's a dangerous offender. Well, that's not changed. May commit for sentence if satisfied it should attract long-term detention. And of course the other option is that they can sentence or adjourn for reports. If the answer is not guilty or no plea is indicated, the next block of questions, first of all, is the offence a grave crime which should attract a sentence of long-term detention? If the answer is yes, off you go to the Crown Court. If the answer is no, proceed to summary trial. Next question, where they're jointly charged with an adult who's been sent to the Crown Court, is it necessary for the interest of justice to send this offender as well? Again, yes, then you send it to the Crown Court. No, then you carry on in the youth court. And finally, are they charged with an offence related to an offence which is being sent already, a different offence being sent today, or that's already been in the Crown Court? Then if the answer is no, you proceed to summary trial. If the answer is yes, then you may send it to the Crown Court for trial.
So in the case of adult offenders, we're looking at the changes are basically getting rid of committal. We're doing committal at the plea before venue stage.
Yes.
There doesn't seem to be any... suggestion anywhere that the Crown have got to have any kind of case before it gets sent, which is a little bit concerning.
Yeah, and
it doesn't even mention prima facie case, let alone...
Well, I think there's probably a bigger problem with it, which is that the usual block, and sorry Home Office to, you know, call shenanigans on your nonsense over the years in terms of what you're telling the public, but the usual block for committals not taking place at the right time is that the Crown Prosecution Service hasn't put its
case together,
as in there's no committal papers.
But that will happen at the Crown. That's the key, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that's the idea, but how much court time is going to be wasted before they get there?
I don't know, and I'm not quite sure. You can't just proceed to sentence, can you, if you've got a defence advocate who's standing up and saying, well, I haven't got the full case yet?
No. So presumably we're going to have lots of plea before venue hearings that are ineffective rather than just committal hearings.
Presumably,
that
yeah. Sure. So the changes there
are... pessimistic, isn't it?
It is. Changes there are that committal is going to take place in effect at plea before venue stage, and you've got these semi-Goodyear indications.
Yeah.
And in relation to you. Much has really changed, and you cannot, there's no suggestion of good year indications in youth cases.
No.
I think that's quite important, because you, even if...
Which, frustratingly, is where they're arguably going to be the most useful.
That's exactly where they'd be most useful.
Well, they are, but there is just that whole inducement factor with the youth, isn't there, that you've really got to watch out for.
They're represented, you'd rather hope that the danger of that was mitigated.
And the thing is, as well, it's the youths who have no previous convictions, so you're always really struggling with the advice on, because it's a case of, well, it's either, what am I going to get? You're either going to get a referral order or custody.
Mm.
And I'd like to know which it's going to be.
The offence is somewhere in between the two. If I plead guilty, will I definitely avoid custody? I can't guarantee that. In those circumstances, it would be ideal to be able to tell the client, but you can ask.
And a practice had somewhat developed in the youth court where those sort of indications were...
Certainly by experienced district judges.
Absolutely. Less so with lay benches. Mm. But then actually, lay benches sitting in youth courts are... To some extent, generally a cut above, because they do have the specific training, and they usually have a bit more experience.
Well, let's hope that doesn't need to end all of a sudden.
It probably will, won't it? It seems that this system is designed to force it to end. But there you go.
Is that it?
I didn't say it was going to be good news. I just said it was going to be good news.
Well, let's move on to Halliwell, which is... It's not really any better news, is it, Jonathan?
Not really. So the case of Halliwell... Mr. Halliwell was charged with two counts of murder. His indictment initially had two counts. The first one was the murder of Sian... is it pronounced...
Sian
O'Callaghan. And the second charge was the murder of Rebecca Godden Edwards. There were two preliminary issues that were dealt with as part of voir dires on two separate occasions.
That's a kind of mini trial within a trial, for anybody out there who doesn't know what we're talking about.
Indeed. And actually, the way that both of these decisions end is sort of looking ahead in time to a trial taking place in February of next year. That trial's not going to be taking place anymore, because the second count on the indictment has been dismissed. The first count on the indictment is now the subject of a guilty plea. So why has that come to be? Well, the two voir dires, the first one that took place was in relation to an abuse of process argument, which was in relation to publicity. I don't think we need to spend too much time on that.
No, I think that's just very straightforward. Yes, oh dear, it was all terrible that there's all this publicity. No, it's not an abuse, move on.
If you want a handy summary of all of the relevant case law in relation to publicity, it's probably a good place to start, because it's nice and up to date.
Which actually...
It does go on and on, actually, about
on a different day, actually, because that's an argument that's going to bob around again fairly soon, I strongly suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
At least said the best for the moment.
Well, quite literally.
We are a publicity machine, that's what you know.
Particularly a Mancunian issue. I'll say no more than that.
The second part of the voir dires was actually chronologically the first. It's referred to as the second in the online summary of the voir dires, but it was actually the first one to happen chronologically. And this one, by far the more interesting, and also the one that was decided in favour of the defendant, but still impossible, as you say, Kirsten, to describe it as anything like good news, because in the circumstances it's led to a severe feeling of injustice, understandably.
Also like to feel that it's a surprise to discover that this is what happened, but actually it's really not.
I think I should preface it by saying that of course, there is the tendency when looking through these matters to wonder whether or not we ever know the full picture of what happened between the police officer during his investigations of the defendant. Perhaps we won't know. We've got the information.
To the police officer, and it's probably the only nice thing I'm going to say about him all that, he seems to have been very honest with it. Probably what raises most of the problems. He doesn't seem to have twigged there were any issues at all with what he was doing.
Well, I'm not sure he twigged that there were no issues, and I found myself when I was reading it, and this really is... I surprised myself, feeling that some of the justification that the officer was putting forward, not all of it, but some of it, I could see where he was coming from. Because he said that he was initially motivated purely by an intention to locate Sean.
But the thing is, this is why you have a police officer.
I'm going to get it wrong more than once.
This is why you have a police officer who is a trained professional.
Yeah.
So as that they can put aside their gut reaction to behave in the same way that Tom, Dick, or Harry, who are going out and assisting in these things, might do. I mean, that's a pathetic excuse.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's go into it.
Yeah, sorry.
Otherwise, the listeners are going to be wondering what we're talking about.
I'm going to rant like crazy.
So you have a police investigation that's going on. I'm not going to go into the early part of the investigation because we'll be here all day. But you get to paragraph 22 of the... I'm just being handed a pronunciation guide, and that's a very good idea.
It's pronounced Sean.
Sean.
Like Sean Lloyd, the weather presenter.
Yeah, okay. So paragraph 22 of the decision on the voir dire is effectively where it starts with this defendant. They spot, by means of automatic number plate recognition, a car, they connect it to him, and they then mark him as a TIE. A TIE is somebody to be traced, interviewed, and eliminated. So it's not a suspect. They wouldn't treat him as a suspect at this stage. And it goes...
Yeah, they wouldn't treat him as a suspect, but I have issues as to whether he is a suspect.
Okay. It's all happening in a very, very...
Why does he need to be eliminated?
Well... At paragraph 23, the policy book entry, which has all the decisions of the senior officer in this case, the senior investigating officer, simply reads, Sean is yet to be found. Surveillance provides the best opportunity of identifying a current location, should Halliwell be prompted to return to the deposition site. So in other words, let's not arrest him. Let's go by means of publicity to see whether he just takes us there while we're putting him under surveillance. Okay, so we go forward. I'm going to go forward quite significantly further in time because there's a point at which, and it's Detective Superintendent Fulcher who was concerned that there was pressure mounting on the defendant which might lead him to commit suicide. And this is happening rapidly. This is over the course of days, if not hours, that this is escalating. And eventually a decision is made to arrest the defendant.
Why did he form the view that the pressure was mounting? What did he mean by that? Is there any explanation?
Bear with me just one moment. I'll see if I can.
I'm just wondering where the pressure came from and whether it came from the police.
Well, they did attend his property. Yeah. They did do a swab.
Thought they might have done.
Well, indeed.
Just a thought.
Indeed.
I'm just thinking of a fairly recent case that occurred.
I think we've got to be careful.
That's, yes.
that's why, you know, when I say at the start of it, there's a huge temptation in this case to wonder what has happened. But
we must not. Let's
carry on. Yeah. Right, so there's a decision made, paragraph 32, when Detective Superintendent speaks to one of the more senior detective sergeants. There's a discussion there. This D.S. Cooper, the detective sergeant, it's Wiltshire, by the way, is the force that's dealing with all this. Ben was asking me before. And D.S. Cooper's role in this was to advise on an interview procedure. And D.S. Cooper advised of the urgent interview procedure under pace code C11-1.
I have to say, I'm slightly concerned that it took D.S. Cooper to tell Detective Superintendent Fulcher what the law was.
Well, it's not the first time that you're going to have those. It's not the last time, rather, that you're going to have those concerns. I think one of the first things that will occur to lawyers when they hear of the urgent interview procedure is it's a bit scary because that's the procedure by which you don't need to actually have legal representation. It can only be used in very rare occasions. D.S. Fulcher, all right, the officer in charge, confirmed that he hadn't used the procedure before. D.S. Cooper said this is one of the occasions where it can be justified because there's a need to find Sean O'Callaghan. And the
which is right, actually.
Yeah, because, of course, at that stage, the whether or not she is still alive or whether
they
she's
fear
dead.
For her safety and they think it will help find her.
And this is what I'm saying when I was saying I found myself at points agreeing with what the officers were saying.
I mean, that's just agreeing with pace. I mean, that's pretty much the only circumstance for which that provision applies in reality. It's pretty much the only situation in which it is used, let's put it that way.
I came across, just to give the listeners an idea of when it can be used, I came across a situation where an urgent interview was conducted with a mother at home because there was a child at the address and they couldn't arrange for alternative childcare, so it was a contemporaneous recorded interview. I won't go into whether or not that was admitted into evidence.
Let's avoid narrative on that particular point.
No, I've used it as well when I've a case with a... It was actually a search and breaking into somebody's house using the same provisions, where the householder had been the person who'd reported her missing to the police, and he took great exception to them then marching into his house. But he
that's
wouldn't.
A different
he,
test.
But he wouldn't let them in. It's similar. It's the fear for somebody's safety. He wasn't. Yes. They didn't, and they don't have to believe that the person is in the property.
No, that's true.
Merely that they may find something in the property that will lead them to. And it's actually pretty much the same. It's a very similar test. Mm.
So, decision number 24, written down by the detective superintendent. Goes down, urgent interview strategy. DS Cooper will prepare an interview strategy to conduct a suspect interview under Section 11.1 of PACE with his Tier 3 interview team, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so plan is in place then for conducting the interview. It goes on to conclude, I have no means of knowing whether Sean is alive or dead, and I consider this to be an emergency situation which requires measures to be taken to identify her location. So, we go forward. There's a point at which... On the 24th of March, the defendant is, while he's under surveillance, deposits some wrappers in a bin outside Boots, and part of the surveillance team appears to inform the detective superintendent that there's a risk there, that what's been purchased is an overdose quantity of paracetamol. So once again, there's an escalation in the seriousness of the potential risk in the mind of the officers. An arrest is carried out the same day. Not long after that is actually observed in the car park of an Asda. And at that time, skipping forward a little bit, a fairly firm arrest was taken. You know, he was taken to the ground, as you might expect.
You're sounding like many an officer I've heard give evidence in the lower courts. A fairly firm arrest took place.
Okay, well, he was taken down.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
They dealt with him robustly, you know.
Ah.
Yes.
So, suspicion of kidnap at that stage. And he was cautioned.
Mm.
He responded that he understood. Placed into the back of a police van. A couple of details. Because this had all been prepared by DS Cooper, the questions to be asked in the interview, because this is when the interview now takes place, right now. And the questions asked were, well... A guidance on the procedure said the questioning is only to establish the whereabouts of Sean and will cease once the risk to Sean's safety has been averted.
Can I just chip in at this point as well? Ben, you were asking why they thought he was a suicide risk.
Was I? Why they thought the pressure had escalated.
Well, press releases at the time were designed deliberately to indicate to the defendant that the police were close to finding Ms. O'Callaghan.
Yes.
In the hope that this would increase the pressure on him and prompt him to return to the place
personally.
Where he had taken her. Yes. Mm. It's noticed that it was the Detective Superintendent Fulcher noted, this is decision 23, it is clear to me that the only way of finding Sean is by Halliwell taking us to her. And the downside of these tactics was the risk of suicide, which was a genuine and informed concern. So hence, you can see why they were...
Mm. Yes, which does lead you to the question, though, that when, let's say, that the purchase of what was suspected to be a suicide quantity of paracetamol from a pharmacy moments before an interview takes place may raise the question of the suspect's mental health at the time that he's then being interviewed.
In honesty, when you look at the overall position of the police in these interviews, I can't imagine that would have ever remotely crossed their minds.
No, quite right.
They're just too busy. They're convinced he knows where she is and this is where
they
are.
Terrified about losing the data, which only exists in the mind of him. That's the only part, really, that I'm saying I can understand.
Oh, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with it. I'm just saying it's certainly a consideration that ought to be at the forefront of their mind.
You do also wonder, well, you've got this worry about whether he'll take them. About what you know, him having to take them to her.
Mm.
But so you do wonder, in terms of if they're going to interview him, why that's a massive consideration. Because either she's dead, which we know she was, or she's being kept somewhere. And yes, it's possible whilst you're interviewing him that something's going to occur. But
if there was someone else involved, I suppose.
Well, it just seems, I'm not quite sure what they hope to gain by the urgent interview, really.
Well, let's have a look what happened. The strategy for the interview was given to a DC's Derek and a DC Bevan, experienced officers, and here's what happened. They arrived on the scene, and the notes are as follows.
Well, they describe the defendant's demeanour during interviews.
Oh, yeah, very calm.
Him looking like a rabbit caught in the headlights.
Ah, well, that's towards the end of this, isn't it?
Having been robustly taken to the ground.
That's at the end of the following. So, Eric, arrest, cautioned explanation of arrest. Focus of the investigation is to find Sian O'Callaghan. Tell me where Sian is.
I don't know.
Can you help us with where Sian is?
I don't know where she is. I don't think I should say any more without speaking to a solicitor.
Do you know if Sian is safe?
No comment.
Can you help us in finding out if Sian is safe?
No comment, not till I speak to a solicitor. Can I go to the police station now?
Now, it then reads, as far as the interviewing officers were concerned, the urgent interview was then at a close, which does make sense, because they've set out what the basis of the interview was. He's not answering the questions. Game over. Right, down the station, or release. So, DC Derek stated he couldn't think of a way of formulating any more questions. Yeah, fine, I can understand that, realistically.
So then what do they actually do?
Goes out, one of the interviewing officers gets out of the car, goes over to speak to DS Cooper, saying that he wasn't saying anything, wanted a solicitor, wanted to go to the police station. And Cooper, so the guy who's been in charge of this entire urgent interview procedure, agreed that this was the end of the matter. Instructed a PS Strange, Police Sergeant Strange, who was already at the scene, to convey the defendant to the custody unit at Gable Cross Police Station. So then a PS Strange and a PSPC hat take the defendant, presumably in the back of a cage of a police van, to a...
Sorry, what was that dude's name?
Strange.
No, the other one.
Hat. H-A-T.
Oh, right, I thought you were saying it was Police Sergeant PC Hat or something.
No, Police Sergeant Strange and Police Constable Hat, yeah. So they set off going to the station. But as they leave, Detective Superintendent Fulcher, who is in the SIO room at Gable Cross, which is recorded in these descriptions as pacing the floor, rang DS Cooper and asked if the defendant had given them any information. He was told the defendant had said nothing, that the urgent interview had now ceased, and that the defendant was now on his way to Gable Cross Police Station. That's when things changed. Detective Superintendent Fulcher instructed Cooper not to send the defendant to the police station, but to have him taken to Barbary Castle. Now, I don't know the area. I was thinking Barbary Castle was a terminology for another police station.
Yeah,
it's not. It's a castle.
Yeah,
because it was where the SIO believed that the body would be, or believed that Sian would be if she was alive. So DS Cooper was given instructions saying he wanted to continue the urgent interview himself. So the boss is effectively saying, "I'll deal with this."
Mm-hmm. So they do that. They take him there, don't they?
They do indeed. They do indeed. What's interesting is that in Decision 26 in the Book of Decisions, the Detective Superintendent noted that the defendant's silence was a refusal by him to identify Ms. O'Callaghan's location. And that is how he viewed it, which
he clearly think he knows that they've decided
he's done it. He's absolutely sure.
And as it happens, he may well have been... He was right.
Yeah, he's pleaded to this. So, yeah, absolutely, he was right.
But he might not have been, is the point.
Indeed.
And in fact, his closed mind as to who was responsible for it may well have ultimately cost him finding the right person in another situation. But anyway, yeah, go on.
DS Cooper immediately told P.I. Ewart. Now, I don't know who P.I. Ewart is in relation to this. To stop the police car that was now on its way to the station, so presumably the driver.
And to take him to Barbary Castle.
Yep. So they stop. P.S. Strange drives the defendant, still handcuffs, to Barbary Castle. Strange doesn't tell PC Hat or the defendant where they're going, but at one stage the defendant says, "Why are we driving to Marlborough?" He's then told that they're going to Barbary Castle, and the defendant appears to nod in acknowledgement. So you can see, are they doing that there as part of the overall attempt to divulge the point of...
I find no difficulty in saying yes.
Okay.
None whatsoever. I would imagine Detective Superintendent Fulcher would have answered yes to that question.
Defendant described as calm.
And he does. He gives a full, frank and unapologetic explanation of the decision that he made.
Sure.
He said his sole purpose was a last appeal to him to give some indication of where Sian O'Callaghan was so as to save her life, and he believed it was necessary for him to personally do it.
Yep.
He goes on... Even though it had failed.
He goes on to say that Notwithstanding the strictures of pace, he took the decision to look the defendant in the eye and to ask him this one thing: will you take me to Sean?
Because he'd either get a reward, get an award, or get sacked. I imagine.
It seems to be clear that Detective Superintendent Fulcher has made a conscious decision to disregard pace.
Well, he does, and he then goes on to actually then run another allegedly urgent interview. And he asks a civilian member of staff to accompany him to write it down, despite the fact there are a number of police officers available to do that. He purposely chooses not to do that because he wants to speak to the defendant one-to-one. It is incredibly worrying.
And here is that second...
And what if he hadn't done it?
Well, this is the scary thing, isn't it?
How far would he have gone?
Here's the context of the second urgent interview. Detective Superintendent Farmer introduced himself and said this: are you going to tell me where Sean is?
Hang on a second. Kirsten, you need to read from this one. We're doing a reconstruction again.
I'm so sorry. I don't know anything.
Are you going to show me where Sean is? What's going to happen? If you tell us where Sean is, that whatever you will be portrayed, you would have done the right thing.
I want to go to the station.
Are you prepared to tell me where Sean is?
You think I did it.
I know you did it.
Can I go to the station?
You can go to station. What will happen is that you will be vilified. If you tell me where Sean is, you will have done the right thing.
I want to speak to a solicitor.
You are being given an opportunity to tell me where Sean is. In 1 hour's time, you'll be in the press.
I want to speak to a solicitor.
You will speak to a solicitor. I'm giving you an opportunity to tell me where Sean is. By the end of this cycle, you will be vilified. Tell me where Sean is.
Have you got a car? We'll go.
Now, what the judge notes there is that it wasn't in dispute that the interview lasted from 12:11 to 12:20. And for any listeners out there who may have been watching their MP3 player's timer, you'll notice that that took us about 30 seconds.
He spoke a lot slower than Kirsten, obviously.
Sorry, yes.
Well, the time they'd cut out all the expletives, I imagine that's what was left.
Well, actually, no. Well, they found that what was cut out of it was the repetition.
Yep.
Detective Superintendent Fulcher repeatedly making the same points, repeatedly asking the same questions.
For a good interview.
How many times had he told him, you will be vilified if you don't, and it's all going to be terrible, and in an hour you're going to be in the press, and it's going to be everywhere, and you're going to be number one?
The superintendent gave a debrief later on that night at the station, where he described the defendant as having eventually agreed to show the officer the deposition site. So the reference to eventually there, I mean, there's no question here, is there? We know what this is.
I mean, it's a good job, isn't it, that he actually then showed him where the body was, as opposed to came up with a confession saying, I've dumped her somewhere in the North Sea or wherever. Mm. Possibly not lightly in this case, but, you know, and you'll never find the body, or I've dipped her in acid and she's disappeared.
Because of his frame of mind, he admitted to committing the murder and, of course, having not done it, had to create some way that he'd dispose of the body, which meant they'd probably never saw
at all. Yeah. That's what I mean. You're dumping her in the North Sea or dipping her in acid or whatever. I mean, that's, you know, and then what? Mm. You've got no body and you've got...
No confession.
You've got a confession.
But you know it's
not admissible.
But you've absolutely no idea whether it's right, wrong or indifferent. And the real murderer could be walking because he's completely determined that this is the murderer.
It's cavalier policing, to say the least.
Paragraph 61.
Or brave.
Yes, it's brave if it's brave if he finds the answer. It's cavalier and foolish if he doesn't.
If this was on television, he would be brave.
It reminds me a little bit of Jane Tennyson, it has to be said.
So, paragraph 61, there was an admission made by Detective Superintendent Fulcher as part of his cross-examination that it was a deliberate decision on his part. He decided not to caution the defendant as part of this second interview. Or not even to remind him that he was still under caution. He said the key issue was to save her life and that aim would be thwarted if he opened the interview by telling the defendant that he was entitled not to say anything. So it's
curse you, pace.
Well,
I'm having a minor heart attack here, I think.
It's as if by this stage the officer's just decided...
Pace is all just a bit in the way. It's all a bit pesky,
well,
this pace.
He's just decided, well, there's already been breaches of it. There's no point trying to. Well, I'm being entirely serious because if the officer's attitude towards it is, I've got this primary concern about the whereabouts of Sean, I've already breached pace.
I actually don't think he'd noticed at this stage that he was in breach of pace at
the judgment is that he did.
What he already had realised. I mean, he obviously realised at the point that he decided not to, when he decides not to do it with a caution.
Because he stated that Sean's right to life was more important than a pace compliant interview.
Oh, bless the police using the Human Rights Act. I love it. It also goes back, though, to the other decision that we're not going to talk about, where we're talking about the publicity aspects of it, where this very same officer referred to foolish legal advice that the defendant had been given to go no comment in interview, by which I think we agreed earlier was basically meant pesky advice. Mm. Really, how annoying for him to do that, because it was clearly the right advice that the solicitor gave in all the circumstances.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem to have any regard at all for any of it.
Go on, what saith the court?
Okay, so effectively do I need to go any further about the contents
no.
of this?
No. He's rode roughshod through pace. Yeah, what's
there were several there were several confessions made. And as a result of the manner in which those confessions were obtained, arguments were raised by the defence. The arguments raised by Mr. Latham for the defence were that there was fundamental breaches of Section 76 of PACE, so that Section 78 is engaged by both Section 76 and just general breaches of PACE.
Non-lawyer listeners, you've obtained confessions and other information through an improper manner and therefore it ought to be excluded.
Yeah. And oppression is relevant as well for Section 76.
The problem here, though, is the fruit from the poison tree, isn't it?
To an extent, it would appear that there isn't any, because otherwise I think...
Well, doesn't he then take them to the body?
Well, there's little information on this.
Oh, okay.
So, Section 76...
So this is the case,
dealt with
this
in detail.
Is the one he's pleaded guilty to, isn't it?
No, we're dealing with both. We're dealing with both, because what happens... If you just bear with me for just a moment...
Sorry, the Sean O'Callaghan is the one he pleaded guilty to.
Yes.
And that's the one he's then gone on to take them to the body, and that would be the fruit of the poison tree, isn't it?
Bear with me.
Meaning that you can breach if you breach these things, but if you then get evidence that otherwise would be admissible from it, you can't mention how you know, but you can potentially use that. And I assume
There's something that we haven't dealt with somewhere. There's something that we haven't dealt with, which is...
Sorry.
Once the interview... in which there were confessions as to the location of Ms. O'Callaghan's body, concluded. The detective superintendent told the defendant he's going to hand him over to a police constable to arrest him for murder, take him to the police station. And the defendant then said to the superintendent, "You and me need to have a chat." I pulled off the road near what must be a pub, pulled over near a small path, and the superintendent and the defendant got out of the vehicle and walked about 30 to 40 metres away with the civilian officer with them, and they sat down on the grass at the edge of the path, and the defendant stated that he was a sick fucker and asked the superintendent whether he wanted another one and told him that he could take him to another location. Didn't arrest him or caution him, again, just continued the process because he thought it might be the only chance to find out what he wanted to show me. Once again, he made the deliberate decision not to caution.
There's no worries here about rights to life at this point.
One would imagine not.
Nope.
So they got back in the police car. Defendant took them to a field 30 miles away near East Leech. And defendant pointed to an area where he said he buried another woman that he killed some point between 03 and 05, and they discovered the remains of Rebecca Godwin Edwards. So, we've got another confession there. Mm-hmm. Now, where does that leave us? Well, again, we started this process. So Section 76 applies, Section 78 applies. There's a whole stream in this judgment. It goes right through the code of practice for detention, treatment and questioning, which is a useful read, especially if you don't know about the urgent interview procedure, which is 11.1 and is dealt with in full. It's all dealt with very thoroughly, and then some decisions are made, and the conclusion of the decision is that the prosecution did not charge the burden that is upon them under Section 76, and that the evidence relating to the confession and location of Ms. O'Callaghan's body is inadmissible pursuant to Section 76.2, so that's the part of PACE that deals with potential oppression.
Well, I think, see, the difference here is that the actual confession is predominantly him taking them to the body, whereas in the Sean O'Callaghan case, you have the confession and then he takes them to the body. They're two sort of separate issues.
Oh, yeah,
aren't
they are. They are separate issues.
So in the case of the second body, you're not talking about fruit from the poison tree, because him taking them to the body was specifically the confession.
Yes, well, indeed. And the conclusion that is reached in relation to the overall evidence is as follows, if you bear with me for just a moment. All questions asked were without caution during the journey to the location of Miss O'Callaghan's body, so evidence admissibility of that evidence would have an adverse effect on fairness and should not be admitted. Mm-hmm. So that's the second part. And the taking of the body of Miss O'Callaghan, that itself is rendered inadmissible in that part.
No, that's the confession. That's everything that goes on in that bit, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then finally, you've got paragraph 119, the situation with Rebecca Godd and Edwards. And effectively, the judge starts off by saying it's all part of the same series of events resulting from the deliberate decision of the detective superintendent to act as he did. And indeed, I'll just go straight to the conclusion, because otherwise we are going to be here for some time. The evidence relating to the confession concerning Miss Godd and Edwards and the location of her body and the circumstances in which they arose would have such an adverse effect on fairness, such that they ought not to be admitted, as per Section 78 of PACE. So the voir dire was granted on what would appear to be all counts. The end result of which is that all of that confession evidence is inadmissible. All of the location of body evidence is inadmissible.
Yeah. So what did they have?
Well, we will never know.
No, it looks exactly on the face of it that they had
zero
him driving around.
Two.
Well, no, they appear to have him. Yeah, nothing at all on the second one.
Yeah.
On the first one, they've got him driving around, and I think they've actually got him on CCTV with her getting into his taxi.
Well,
and he's acting suspiciously.
They've also got him cleaning stuff off his car, burning things at the side of the road.
Hang on a moment. All of this perhaps was unnecessary, it turns out.
Well, the thing is, he's pleaded guilty to number one.
They have found the body, I suppose, at the end of the day.
But the thing is,
and they know the location of the body.
But this is not actually a judgment that is about the specifics of this case. That's what leaps out of this. This is a judgment that sets out that even in cases where you're investigating capital offences, you are bound by a set of rules, and you cannot ride roughshod over them simply because you think it might be the right thing to do.
It's the greater good.
The behaviour of this police officer, even though he effectively came clean down the line, was an absolute bloody disgrace.
Well, I don't think he did come. I don't think he needed to come clean, did he? Because he just doesn't at any point. That's the worrying thing about this case. He doesn't at any point consider that what he is doing is wrong, or consider that maybe there was another way. In particular, with the second one, you think, well, at that stage, you can't help feeling that even if he'd cautioned him at that stage, chances are he'd have taken him to the body.
For me, it's the intervention. There's a point at which the detective superintendent stops the process from proceeding in the way that was planned with D.S. Cooper. He physically asks for the car to be moved. The car goes to the castle. And from that point onwards, the entire investigation is scuppered.
Yeah.
But you can rather, unfortunately, you can imagine it rather clearly. It's, I'll come and sort this bastard out.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a little
very old-fashioned, you know, policing.
Yeah, it's a little old-fashioned.
It's a little bit Gene Hunt, and, you know, for the same reasons that most of the confessions that Gene Hunt's beaten out of people wouldn't be admissible, neither was this.
Not now.
Well, not now, yeah.
No.
Neither is the nonsense that this officer is engaged in.
It's just outrageous.
The fact that they had the right man in this case does not, and do not be confused, must not, in any circumstance, justify the means that reached that end.
Some cases it's worse. Because if they hadn't got the other evidence in regard to Sian O'Callaghan,
absolutely,
somebody that they were absolutely certain had murdered these two would have walked, and that's even worse.
Which many described as, and of course he was found not guilty in the criminal courts, and it's outside of this jurisdiction, but it's what people sometimes refer to as OJ syndrome.
Indeed.
Well, we're left with a bit of a down note there, aren't we? But certainly I could imagine that it would be quite common a criticism in the media to say that this is a technical defence that's been put forward. Yes, it probably is.
Actually, to be fair, I don't think the media have. I think the media have been outraged with the fact that we've lost another one because of the behaviour of the police officers.
Well, that's it. That's the point that I wanted to make, was that that one has to look at conduct. And in a situation like this, this is, I think, a fairly unprecedented ability here to look at the actual conduct of one specific high-ranking officer to see how he's chosen to conduct a very high-profile case. To look at what you can see, everything that he did, you can see the moment where it went wrong. That's your answer.
But the problem with all these cases, I mean, there are so many cases where this sort of thing happens, where if they just stuck to the rules, you'd have a safe conviction, as it turns out. Certainly in regard to that second one, I can understand the justification in regard to the first one, particularly at the point where they thought she was still, if they thought she was still alive, then I can understand why they got ahead of themselves and didn't follow the rules. I'm not saying that I think that's right. I can understand that. But by the time we get to the second one, and it's quite clear we're looking after we're looking at a dead body.
It was in for a penny, in for a pound.
There's nothing. That's just, well, you should have cautioned him at that stage. It's just, and I mean, it should have cautioned him throughout. Don't misunderstand me.
It should serve as a reminder to all officers, I think, that, you know, the reason that we have PACE rights in the UK, Miranda rights in the States, and the various other rights across the world that sort of roughly parallel each other, is because they serve a very clear purpose. It means that if you do get a conviction, then it is far more likely to be a safe one. Officers engaged in matters such as planting evidence and so on know that they're taking a particular course of action, and they probably know the likely consequence of it. They hope they get lucky. Officers who ride roughshod over PACE rights do not always appreciate that what they're doing potentially might have this sort of consequence. And I include in that police officers, even at a junior level, who do things such as, before a police interview starts, when they've got a suspect in custody, run the rather cliched old line of, yeah, well, look, you know, you can wait till you get a solicitor here, mate, but there's a duty on tonight. Well, look, it'll take him hours to get here, and, you know, we could just have a chat, probably nothing come of it, and you know, we can get you out of here in an hour or so. Seriously, that line
happens again and again and again.
It is such a cliche.
And while we're on the subject, when did you last deal with an interview where somebody made a significant statement and it was the first thing that was put to them in interview? PACE says it has to be the first thing that's put.
Or
when
indeed
did you last see
where a separate tape is used to put previous convictions and so on. Yeah, these are all things. That one doesn't come from PACE, but these are all these are all provisions that exist for a purpose, and no matter how much of a righteous indignation you may think you have about these damn rights that get in the way, well, I think that this case at least sends one message, which is you will bloody well obey them.
And the number of cases that get lost because
at all costs,
police officers just don't do what they're supposed to do, and it drives you insane.
There was a similar Miranda rights case in the States, fairly high profile, about a year or two ago, the details of which completely escape me. If you're one of our listeners in the US, and we know we have some, then if you manage to put your finger on the case that I'm talking about, it was a high profile, it wasn't a murder, I don't think. But by all means, send us the details, because it would be quite interesting to compare them. Anyway, gosh, that's taken a long time.
It's a long case.
It is a long case. What have we got that we can whiz through super fast?
Very quickly, the Crown against Simmons.
Yep.
This one really is quite bizarre, I think. I'm slightly concerned because it is potentially still within the... Well, it's still within the appeal window, although, interestingly, the last line of the record of the judgment I have got, and I think this is down to Crime Line, I think it might be.
What's that, Simmons?
Yes.
I think so.
It's not
thank you, Mr. Keogh.
I'm going to say a proper law report, if you see what I mean, but the last line is, the court said they reluctantly upheld this sentence, which perhaps suggests that they're almost inviting somebody to say,
right,
can we send this to the Supreme Court then? So, yes.
Yep.
But what is interesting in this, it's an interesting case because it's about taking, what you might think it's about, taking drugs into a prison.
Well, it is, isn't it, Kirsten?
Apparently not. Apparently it's about the offence of bringing a prohibited article into prison.
Has that been charged correctly?
Indeed. Contrary to Section 40B of the Prisons Act 1952, the appellant, Miss Simmons, who was a previous good character, was sentenced to 6 months' detention in a young offenders institution, having turned 18 during the course of proceedings, actually.
Yep.
She She was of good character, and it was also accepted by everybody that she was under pressure. She was being coerced to some degree.
To take the stuff in.
To take the stuff in. Right. The drugs were...
As is pretty common in these cases.
Yeah. The drugs were class B.
Yep.
So they were cannabis. The person she was taking them into was given 13 weeks imprisonment.
Difficult that's 1-3.
Difficult to know whether that's because of some kind of totality of how long he was serving in terms of all the other sentences.
Sure.
I don't know. That's
no
possible. Her co-accused, Mr. Coop, who was not of good character, also got 6 months, exactly the same sentence.
And is this the person who was coercing her?
The person who was predominantly coercing her, I think, is actually Smith.
Right.
Smith, the guy on the inside?
He's the guy on the inside, so he's persuading her.
Through an agent on the outside, one would imagine.
One would imagine, and it's difficult to tell whether that was Mr. Coop, although it was held that Coop had a significant role to play, and it was appreciated that in such circumstances it was difficult for the appellant to resist the pressure she was under. So I'm surprised they got the same sentence. I'm not going to go any further than that because of the... I just find it very strange all round.
Yep.
The appeal was on the basis that under the drugs guidelines, which include guidance on sentencing an offender for taking a package of this sort into a prison.
Right.
It would be a level 4, and she would be probably a lesser offender because of the coercion, if you look at the guidelines. It's difficult because the only place it mentions taking things into prison, if you're not a prison officer, if you're a prison officer, an employee of the prison, it's a leading role. If you are not a employee of the prison, it classes as a significant role if you were not acting under coercion. Well, in this case, she's acting under coercion.
Although I have heard judicial interpretation of that to the contrary, but yeah, that seems to be the gist, and I have to say that's the common sense reading of it.
Sure.
The level below, the lesser involvement, doesn't actually mention it at all.
No.
So I would suggest that the where you're going to be looking at is the borderline between level the lesser and the significant.
Yep.
Because it's clearly quite, you've got your lesser role, but hey, it's a prison, come on.
Yeah.
Or you've got, well, she's gone in, but there was no coercion. So it's somewhere between the two.
Yeah.
Point for that is a medium community order.
Correct.
She's looking at 6 months,
which is a pretty epic departure from the...
Isn't that on a guilty verdict as well?
Yes, after trial of good character, and it was a plea.
Yeah,
so
she's of good character, and she's
level,
being
so
coerced.
This is a big departure from previous authorities. In case you're wondering where these guidelines put it, I think we've actually covered that on a previous show.
Okay.
So
what the Court of Appeal said was, in effect, yes, but she's not charged under the drugs, supply of drugs. She's charged under bringing a prohibited article into prison, and on that basis, sentencing is different.
Because now, it still basically follows the line of the previous authorities, there being no specific guideline for it.
What is interesting is that she was actually charged with both, pleaded to the prohibited article...
Or the wrong one, as
you might think... and actually, she clearly pleaded to both.
The interesting thing
is... But there was no separate penalty given for that. And you just think, well, how on earth did that... How did they both finish up on the indictment anyway, and then she pleaded to... I don't know how that happened. I'm not even going to go down that route.
Am I not right in thinking, though, that the maximum, the statutory maximum for the 40B Prison Act offence...
Is less.
Is lower than the one
for supply.
So that is the one. If you weren't really up to date on whether or not the guidelines applied,
that's
which is
the one
totally
you
understandable,
would naturally
you'd go for that
to.
One.
I think that is totally understandable. I think that's bloody appalling.
Of a defendant.
Yes, but this was not somebody without representation. Well, I don't think it was.
No,
anyway.
But I can understand what Jonathan's saying. Your first thought would be, when you're looking at it, is, okay, well, the guy, you know, you're going to get less for that than
and
this.
And when you're properly advised that the...
I think it's a legal advice. I think you're about to advise on this in the law. That would be your starting point. I'm not suggesting that you then shouldn't look it up. Having said that, we have all found it very hard today to find sentencing guidelines on the prohibited article.
Whereas
matter.
We know what they say on
well,
the law,
that's,
which is
I have to say that's,
to find.
Yes, having said that, that's because I haven't got a copy of Banks this evening.
I still don't know whether I'd find it that easy to make the decision. I still don't know whether I'd say, well, I've got the guidelines for X, I've not got the guidelines for Y. So I'm going to advise you to do X, even though I know the statutory maximum is higher.
Well, you before that hearing, you would
you
find
would have looked them up. You would have gone and looked them up in Banks or Thomas or one
I'm
of those books.
I'm putting myself in the position of somebody who's not got the time.
You've always got the time. You're always, aren't you?
Yeah. Wasn't this a youth as well?
Sure.
Well, she's
sure.
on the borderline of it.
So anyway,
yes. So anyway, I don't know how that all finished up, but it just seems very bizarre that you would say, well, A, which is sort of Jonathan's point, it does seem very bizarre that you would get more for an offence that carries a lesser maximum tariff than you would for exactly the same than you would under another offence. Exactly the same circumstances, but had a higher tariff. That is,
I think the answer. I think the answer is this: the Sentencing Guidelines Council clearly set out, even putting aside this question of interpretation about the lesser and significant roles, they had set the tariff for this type of offence in a certain sort of area.
Yeah,
that was at odds with the previous. If you like jurisprudence, the guidelines that had been handed down by the Court of Appeal in relation to drug supply cases quite dramatically at odds with
so
it.
So we're then talking about exactly the same offence, same statute and everything, but the guidelines come in and reduce it.
Yeah, so what happens here is that you've got an offence which is covered by guidelines and has been tempered by those guidelines versus one that is still subject to the old, if you like, common law jurisprudence in terms of sentencing from the Court of Appeal, which, as it happens, would place this higher in the range.
But do we think it is bizarre that the Court of Appeal, in effect, have said, doesn't matter that it would have been exactly the same offence? We don't. Why? It's almost chance, isn't it, that she's charged with one rather than the other?
Well, no, it's clearly a decision taken by the prosecuting authority to charge with one that's going to produce a higher sentence.
Well, they charged with both.
Well, okay, they hedged their bets.
Which is. But can it be right that you could do one set of
she's pleaded to both. I find that very odd
the whole thing everywhere you go through this.
I wonder if there's a salient detail missing somewhere, but hopefully it'll be appealed higher and we'll find out, but it does seem
very odd that you could do one set of circumstances and because of the manner in which you're charged, and particularly when that choice is actually almost the odd one. Most people would be charged under the Supply of Drugs Act.
I wonder if it's just a cynical charging decision.
I doubt it. You know, I doubt they've even thought about it either. I think they've just said, yeah, she's taking, you know,
well, it's
going into prison.
It kind of escaped the notice of the Crown Prosecution Service that the sentences being handed down for drug supply into prisons are lower under the guidelines than they were under the guideline authorities.
And therefore those, charge that which gets you the higher sentence.
Yeah, and to be clear, the guideline authorities that were suggesting 4 or 5 years being the going rate, those authorities were pretty blunt in terms of coercion cases. They said, well, yeah, that's what we expect to find in these cases. There's usually coercion.
Oh, absolutely.
And intimidation.
Yep.
And yes, that is mitigation, not much.
But then to just completely ignore the... I mean, they don't completely ignore it, that would be unfair, but to say, yes, well, the guidelines don't cover X... It's very much a technicality. And that's something the Court of Appeal have a history more recently of throwing out technicalities. I think it's a very bizarre decision all around, and particularly, of course, because of that last line that they reluctantly upheld the sentence. That's an unusual statement from the Court of Appeal.
Let's see what happens.
Yes, indeed.
I wonder if that's an indication from the Court of Appeal that they thought it was all a little bit cynical too. But anyway, time will tell. Very, very briefly, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a choice now, haven't we?
Well, let's have a quick look. Have you got...
I can tell you a little bit about the case of X. This is the rights of a sex offender to make representations before a disclosure is made. All right, this is CSOD, the Child Sex Offender Disclosure Scheme. The case, and I'll give you the citation for this one because you may want to look it up because I'm probably not going to cover it.
It'll be in the
detail.
Show notes.
Yeah,
promise.
Well, let's just hope it is. 2012, EWHC 2954, admin. Kirsten's looking at me like, seriously, why would I ever forget it? Because. All right, very quickly then.
If you give it to me, it'll be in the show notes.
The particular facts are not desperately interesting. 1990, the claimant enters a guilty plea to the Sheffield Crown Court to two offences of indecent assault on a child, is sentenced to 2 years imprisonment. In 1996, he pleads guilty to 4 offences of indecent assault on a child and sentenced to 4 years imprisonment. And as a result of that, he's placed on the Register of Sex Offenders and remains on it for life, subject to being able to make, from 2013, an application for removal under the new legislative provisions, which came into force on the 1st of August 2012. Very exciting so far. March 2010, then, the Home Secretary sets up a statutory scheme called the Child Sex Offender Disclosure Scheme Guidance Document. Indeed, CSOD. This is piloted in a couple of areas, but the details of it aren't statutory. Just to be clear, it's statutory that a scheme should be created. That scheme...
It's basically Claire's law for sex offenders, isn't it?
Yeah,
we're going to go and tell people, if you've got sex offences, we're going to tell people about
It's not new ground because of other schemes, and the court considered them. So the two questions that were raised simply were this. Firstly, the CSOD guidance sets out inadequate... procedural safeguards for an offender in respect of whom disclosure is to be made, as the offender is not given the opportunity to make representations. So point one, should an offender be given an opportunity to make representations before disclosure is made? Question two, or issue two, I suppose, the CSOD guidance misstates the test that the police must apply in deciding whether to make disclosure. That's kind of a similar point to point one, but details... not desperately important. So the court went on to consider the various different schemes which currently apply in relation to disclosure about previous convictions for child sex offenders. And don't forget, we're not just talking about convictions. This is convictions and other relevant information. So this is intelligence and so on and so forth. All right, so there's common law duties. There's the obligations under MAPA, multi-agency public protection agreement. There's specific obligations under the Criminal Justice Act 2003, and there's this CSOD scheme. I'm not going to trawl through all of it, but basically...
What's the result?
Well, I'll give a little bit more detail. First of all, the common law really is kind of the important one, and I'm reminded, actually, of it, of a case called Thorpe from 1999, which is where Claire's law is kind of interesting, because that's not solely to do with child sex cases. In that case, Lord Chief Justice Bingham, as he then was, found that there was a general duty that had to be looked at in a certain way. The body responsible for disclosure of this information should not disclose such information save for the purpose of, and to the extent necessary, performance of its public duty, or enabling some other public body to perform its public duty. So far, so good. In exercising the judgment, there had to be a careful and bona fide judgment that it is desirable or necessary in the public interest to make disclosure, whether for the purpose of, and here's kind of the point, preventing crime is one option, or alerting members of the public to an apprehended danger, then they can go on to make such limited disclosure as is necessary for the purpose that they intend to make it. All good so far. He went on to say it could never be acceptable if decisions were not made without very close regard being paid to the particular facts of the case. That's kind of the point that ultimately seals the deal in this case. I won't bore you with the details about MAPA and everything else. You can go and read it in the judgment. But what the court said in this matter, if I skip all the way forward to the end, is really that's the point, that whatever assumptions and presumptions this new scheme purports to make, the fact is that it is not a statutory scheme. It doesn't have the same safeguards that exist in MAPA, which is a statutory scheme, in so much as MAPA requires that there is a risk of serious harm to children, and disclosure can only be made if it's necessary to protect from that risk of serious harm. Also, MAPA is directed at the management of risk caused by the offender and giving disclosure in that context, whereas CSOD is aimed at giving a right to the public to obtain disclosure. You may be thinking Megan's Law at this point, and yes, that's exactly what CSOD effectively is designed to be. The guidance that's given in CSOD does sort of slightly mitigate its sort of Megan's Law approach. But in terms of the question of whether an offender should be asked for his view, it actually does say that there may be occasions when it may not be appropriate to inform the subject, not consult or anything else, the subject that disclosure is taking place. On occasion, it may also be appropriate to involve the subject in self-disclosure. This is the idea that they will sit there with a police officer or staff member or sometimes one of the other members of MAPA to make that disclosure. Or, in fact, in certain circumstances, they can be told to make the disclosure themselves and then checks will be made as to whether they have.
Yeah.
They say in the guidance, and this is kind of what's done for them really, this protection, this safeguard, or sorry, this potential mechanism does two things. One, involve, and this is quoting from their own guidance, involving the subject in the disclosure may facilitate their understanding of the risk they pose of causing harm to a child and allow the subject to be part of their own offender management. Good idea. It also enables the subject to object and to provide reasons why the information should not be disclosed. Now, there's the point. Secretary of State, Home Secretary, argument is the fact that there's a conviction wouldn't be in dispute, and so it's for the person making the decision whether to make the disclosure to balance these considerations, and there's no need to ask an offender about something like that. After all, they're the offender. On the behalf of this particular offender, the submission was that Article 8 is engaged. They could only protect Article 8 if there was some sort of safeguard in place, which actually is what Article 8 says. Mm-hmm. And in short, the particular safeguard here should be that they should have the right to provide information. Do you know what? The court in this case actually came up with a far better argument than simply saying Article 8 applies. And that's perhaps this. I'm skipping massively ahead here. They say that... I'm skipping very far ahead. They say that the guidance, the CSOG guidance, ought to, this is paragraph 41 of the judgment, ought to have set out a requirement that the decision maker consider in the case of any person about whom disclosure might be made, whether that person be asked if he wishes to make representations. They say, in the generality of cases, without that person being afforded such an opportunity, so in other words, generally speaking, if you don't, the decision maker might not have all of the information necessary to conduct the balancing exercise which he is required to perform justly and fairly.
Bit of a check that they've got the right...
Well, yeah, and
if got the right details on his antecedents for a start would be quite nice.
Well, they say that there's a possibility for that, but in any event, yeah, it's not just about the antecedents because we're not just talking about convictions; we're also talking about intelligence
that may just be rubbish.
You have precisely the point the court found here. Whilst each case, they say, will turn on its facts, it is difficult to foresee cases where it would be inappropriate to seek representations unless there was an emergency or seeking the representations might itself put the child at risk. Fair enough. So, in other words, I like the way they've disposed of this case as well. It's rather elegant. Now, they've said, this is paragraph 43, they've said, we therefore conclude that the CSOG guidance sets out a policy and process that in a number of specific cases may well not comply with the applicable legal principles. In other words, this is unlawful. They were invited to quash the guidance, which they refused to do because they said it might bring the whole scheme to a temporary halt, which would be disproportionate and risk harm to children to do that. So what they've said is, subject to the court receiving a timetable for amendment of the guidance, the court will make a declaration to reflect the conclusion that they've set out in paragraph 41 of the judgment, and they would invite counsel to agree the precise terms of that declaration, and if they cannot, then the matter will be dealt with by way of written submissions. So in short, what you're doing in this guidance is almost certainly illegal. The very simple basic principle for the non-lawyers is this, that to make a decision as a public body who is responsible for making a decision, so as not to get into bother with the High Court, you must make sure of a number of things. First of all, and this case turns around, that you have all of the relevant information that you ought to have to make the decision. The reason why I find this this judgment appealing, to avoid any puns, is simply this. If you are involved in JR, judicial review proceedings in the High Court on any sort of frequency, particularly in my experience in prison law cases, one of the big problems you have on recall cases in prison matters is the fact that very rarely is the information from the offender, the person on licence, taken into consideration at the point that recall is decided upon.
Yep.
That is a bone of contention that stretches back through all of the case law. And the High Court has repeatedly effectively brushed aside the fact that the offender's information has not been advanced at the time of the decision making. problem is, when you reach a judicial review and the offender wants to put his position forward, technically speaking, it's too late. Mm. The question isn't what should the right decision have been. The question is, was the decision lawful? And if
it
the High Court, absolutely, if the High Court is now saying, no, you need the full story,
then it's not lawful.
Which is absolutely. So I think this case probably has some. I mean, it remains to be seen whether it's got any particularly significant ramifications, but it might have.
All right. Next week, it's Halloween.
Ooh, I've got spooky music somewhere as well, but I'm not going to play it.
That means we're going to be recording late because this witch and these warlocks, I think, have covens to go to. So we'll be recording on Thursday night. So anything you want to ask us to cover or any points you want to make, you can tweet us at
Northpod Law.
You can phone us on
0161408 5037,
or you can send us an email at mail@northpod.co.uk.
But for now, thank you very much for joining us, and we will speak week.
Bye bye.